Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Imagine it, the moment many closeted young adults dread, when your stern, devoutly religious father discovers you are gay. The youngest of 13 children, Tina Alexis Allen, grew up in the 1980s suburban Maryland in a house ruled by her father, Sir John, an imposing British-born authoritarian who had been knighted by the Pope. Sir John supported his large family running a successful travel agency that specialized in religious tours to the Holy Land and the Vatican for pious Catholics. But his daughter Tina was no sweet and innocent Catholic girl. A smart-mouthed high school basketball prodigy, she harbored a painful secret. She was attracted to girls. When Tina was 18, her father uncovered the truth about her sexuality. But instead of dragging her to confession or the family priest, her father simply took her hand and said, "I buried my lover Omar in the war," making Tina his unlikely confidant and creating a clandestine bond that would evolve into what became a web of secrets and lies. And no, this is not a novel. This is a memoir. The book, Hiding Out, a memoir of drugs, deception, and double lives, written by Tina Alexis Allen. She was our guest last week, and we have her once again this week. Tina, welcome to Common Threads once more.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
Certainly. You know, when I was reading your book, I couldn't help but think about Godfather 3.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I mean, did any of that come to you when you were... let's see here. When did 3... 3 came out, I think. Wasn't it in the 90s?
It was a long time ago. I get a little bit... I haven't seen those in ages, but you know, it's The Godfather. So, yeah, there's a lot of connection to... you know, it's been chronicled, the connection from Vatican to mafia, Italian mafia. And there's an amazing book called The Vatican Connection that is a super fascinating book about some money laundering and fake counterfeit bonds, U.S. bonds that supposedly were sold or created by the Vatican back in the 70s that had a big New York mafia connection, and a police officer, a New York detective that was basically covering the mafia in New York City, overheard sort of some, you know, kind of, you know, middle players, you know, listening to them at their clubhouse, wiretapping, and heard the Vatican mentioned. And that became the book, The Vatican Connection, and that detective, I think his last name is Coffey, went on a, you know, I don't know how many years search and investigation about tracking down these U.S. counterfeit bonds. So there's some big stories when it comes to the Vatican Bank and not so far-fetched from Godfather 3, actually.
Right. So the thing that I see, that the common thread, if you will, between Godfather 3 and your life, the book that came out of it, is Godfather 3 opens with Michael Corleone being knighted by the church. Your father was knighted by the church. And clearly, if you saw Godfather 1 and 2, then you realize, whoa, wait a minute here. Why is a murderer like Michael Corleone being knighted by the church? And so, you know, I'm reading your book and finding out that your father was knighted. So the question comes to mind, what does it take to be knighted by the church?
Well, it's very interesting. There are different organizations, the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre, and different levels of knighthood that you can achieve. And I think the short answer and the more, I guess, answer that the church would give would be that you're doing good works for the church. Now, good is a word, I guess, with a lot of meaning, different meanings in this case, but meaning that technically you're propagating the faith, that you're, my father was doing work in the Holy Land. He obviously was giving money to, you know, some orphanage in that we raised money for, but these weren't major things in the sense of, you know, making an incredible impact on the church. That said, as I become closer to his life, for those who listened last week and became sort of my father's confidant at 18, learning about his homosexuality, I also got closer to his Vatican connections, if you will. So I started to work for him in the summers, and I was his chosen one at that point. Other family members were at different times in the office and close to him, but this was a different kind of close because of the personal side of it. And I saw, you know, I saw briefcase of money, I have, you know, passports, a lot of things that raised questions that I've since been trying to track down and reveal all of that in my book. So it's complicated, and I don't have the hard, fast answer for what exactly you have to do, but I'm pretty sure him being knighted had a lot to do with the secret servant work. That's the way I describe it, that he was doing. I mean, how does one get a Vatican passport?
Unless you're born in the Vatican. How many people are born in the Vatican?
Yeah, and born there, but also, you know, if you're working there, actually, some people to get in and out, or living there.
Sure.
So you can live there, I guess, as an employee. There are people, and of course, cardinals and people who are studying and people who are living, working in the Vatican, mostly priests, do have passports. But my father was neither, and he lived in Washington, D.C., and was a Catholic travel agent. He also, which I talk about in the book a little bit, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but, you know, he was also in Russia in 1957, and no one was in Russia in 1957. And as I like to say, he sure wasn't selling pilgrimages to the Kremlin. So there's a lot of places he was that make no sense.
And you never felt, at least at that age, the one or two possibilities. Either you just didn't have quite the level of curiosity that you have now, or you really were still, even though you had this very special personal relationship with him, you just didn't want to confront him on too many things. Is that it?
Absolutely. Absolutely the latter. It's not that I wasn't curious. I was, but I was a person who was keeping a lot of my own secrets and lies in and outside of my family. You know, it's not like I confided everything with my dad. I still was, in my own way, I think, legitimately afraid of him, intimidated by him, despite the fact that I had become his chosen one, if you will, at that period of time. You know, I knew I was special to him in a way, but I didn't ever feel permission to press him about anything, because, you know, he could be a rageful person. And even though I was on his good side, you know, it's sort of like getting hit, right? Once you've been hit, there's always that threat. And so you never forget that. And I think for me, I always, you know, felt that way. And certainly at 18, I didn't overnight now have great confidence in standing up and pressing my father for answers.
Sure.
I got a little bolder, but I never pressed him, even in my whole lifetime, for answers.
And one other thing that correlates to Godfather 3 is your father told you, in no uncertain terms, at least that's how I read it, he believes Pope John Paul I was murdered.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that absolutely is information that he shared with me. That was in his opinion, not even a question, not even a possibility, but a definitive thing. And I can't tell you why he said that, or who he spoke to, was connected to, that would have made that so definitive for him, because I wasn't there. I can only tell you the way he presented it to me. I mean, there have been some books written. There certainly are many theories as to that actually happening. Of course, the Vatican has denied it, and I'm sure would always deny that. And, you know, who's to say? But for sure, he had a lot of information. And there was a cardinal who was Canadian that my father knew quite well, Gagnon, I believe is his name, Cardinal Gagnon, who was at the Vatican during this time, John Paul I, I believe. And then he knew too much. And that was another thing. My dad, I remember him telling me a few stories of that cardinal being afraid for his life and had then requested from John Paul II to be transferred out of the Vatican where he was working because he didn't feel safe. And he went back to Canada for a while. He eventually returned to the Vatican, I believe, and worked once again many years later. But he needed to get out. So there were stories like that my dad would share. And of course, you know, he often would say, and some of my other siblings have a little bit of recollection of this too, that my father was often aware that there might be somebody watching him, following him, and he'd say to me on many of occasion that it was Mossad, which is, for those who don't know, the Israeli intelligence, like the equivalent to our CIA. And, you know, my dad was very pro-Palestinian. He was there during the occupation. He was there, obviously, during the war. He had strong feelings. He saw a lot of people killed. And so he's always been on that side of it. And that was, you know, that's where he stands or stood. So I think all of that kind of plays into this mystery of, wow, there are so many layers, which I try to uncover in the book as part of the rest of it, which is this wild journey of basically partying with my dad all over the world, you know, as these, you know, two gay people in a devout family of 15, including my parents, living this crazy wild existence and hiding out all along. So it's a very big, big, big story with a lot of layers and yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Tina Alexis Allen. She is the author of Hiding Out, a memoir of drugs, deception, and double lives. So, Tina, of course, you write about your entire family, meaning your parents and your siblings, and I'm just mm-hmm. curious about some of the dynamics. First of all, your father could be quite rageful. Very, very angry person, alcoholic. You got kind of a pass at some point when he discovered that you were gay, and mm-hmm. and he came out to you the night that he found out you were gay. And I'm just curious, at that point, what was his relationship with the rest of the family, particularly the kids?
Well, go on. I was 18 when that happened. And that is actually, I've written a book from my 18-year-old voice into my early 20s. So it's written first person. And so what you learn in my book is that I was obviously the youngest, and a lot of my siblings were already out of the house because, remember, I'm the youngest of, you know, my oldest sibling is more than 15 years my senior. So a lot of my siblings were already married with their own families and out of the house. So in these years that we're in this bubble together, I'm literally like almost I'm the last one home. So I do go away to college, but, you know, I'm still in Maryland, which is where we grew up. So I'm not far away, and I'm home a lot and seeing my dad on weekends. So a lot of it happens sort of in a bubble. I mean, I think my mother and some of my siblings started getting a bit curious, like, oh, you're the favorite. And it wasn't unlike my father to sort of have a flavor of the month, if you will, or a flavor of the year. And you know, that, you know, but this this was different. This went on for years. We start traveling together. He's meeting me over in Athens and Rome and Jordan. We have a trip when I'm off to Egypt. I mean, it was bigger and it was different. So he still was the same man to my siblings. It's just that I became, you know, the center of his world for this period of time in terms of the family. But mm-hmm. I think he was still remaining consistent with other people.
Once everybody moved on, they were adults, they mm-hmm. started their own families. Was he nicer to them?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's I'm imagining, and I've had this conversation with some of my siblings. I think my father in general had an easier time with babies, with smaller, you know, where you're not talking back. I think where things probably got tough, I guess every parent is different, but I think a lot of parents do have more challenges when people become teenagers. And I imagine having 4 or 5 teenagers at a time, 6, 7, that can probably get pretty intense, plus the pressure of supporting them. And then all the other complications we've talked about, like lifestyle and drinking and traveling and not being home. So I think those earlier years was where he was the roughest. But as my brothers grew, you know, over 6 feet, and my father wasn't, and as people got, a stronger voice and a stronger sense of self and became adults, he was still always going to be dad. But I think he knew he couldn't get away with as much. Let's put it that way, right?
Sure.
He wasn't, you know.
I saw a brief interview that you had with Megyn Kelly, and gosh,
yeah.
Thank you so much. I mean, once you're on Megyn Kelly and then you're on Cabin Threads, what a mensch you are.
Absolutely. Are you kidding me? Listen, you know, Michigan is just as important as anywhere else in the country. And, you know, my goal with this book is it's a very audacious. And as I've said, you know, we know it gets graphic at times. And all that is very purposeful, because I just want this book in the end to hopefully be a mirror that people get to hold up. And it's not that they've had my life. It's just that we all have secrets. We all have lies. We all have things that we're ashamed of, that we haven't told our husbands or our wives or our partners, that we're still holding shame about and walking with our shoulders a little slumped around that issue. I want people to know that, you know, life is better without all that baggage. And I think everyone deserves, you know, and whether it's the Common Thread listener or the Megyn Kelly listener, we're all the same, you know, we're all one, and I'm really happy to be on your show.
Well, I appreciate that. I do appreciate that, because not all authors have that mindset. But on that interview, yes. Megyn read a statement purportedly by your siblings. At least what I understood, it was written by 12 people or agreed upon by 12 people. I don't know if that's true, but
no.
Essentially, it's saying that we don't buy what she says. Can you respond to that? What is your relationship with your siblings today? And I realize we're not talking about them as a monolithic group. We're talking about 12 different individuals.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, that statement that Megyn read, and you can watch it on YouTube for those who are interested. You can watch my whole segment. She was lovely, by the way. Basically, one of my brothers, two of my brothers molested me when I was a child for quite a number of years. And I also had a middle school teacher who I had engaged in a sexual liaison with. Which, of course, now I would call child abuse. Then I didn't really know better because of obviously what had already happened to me with my brothers. So these are big ticket items, and I'm sorry to sort of drop it out there like that. The book is not heavily about that in any which way or form, but it is the context for which I have a behavior that you are going to read about. So I did find it important to say that context and give the reader the context for my behavior. The point of it is that those are the big ticket items, and everyone in my family knows that to be a fact, what I just said. Everyone in my family, I think if you were to look them in the eye and ask them that question, they would say yes. Now, what my family, and I don't say my family again generically, I have, that statement was written by one of my brothers, but not the two that I just mentioned. It was written by the youngest brother, and he was claiming to have the voice for the majority of the family, which I believe is what he quoted, that he's speaking for the majority. My sister was in the audience, one of my seven sisters, who clearly knows this to be true and supports me. And I have, I would say, a majority of the family that actually supports me and what's in the book. There are some that are struggling, and I feel for them, and I understand that sometimes, you know, some of this stuff being public when you're not a public person can be painful. But I also know the importance of a legacy. And I think my legacy, and I hope my family's legacy, will be to lean into the truth, to not be ashamed of the truth. I have forgiven my brothers. And by the way, abuse does not happen in a vacuum. And I'll leave it at that. So I will just say I'm not the only one that has suffered in my family. But that was not and is not my story to tell, any of those stories. But everyone in my family knows what the truth is. Now, what they don't know specifically, because they didn't experience, is that I'm in clubs, you know, acting the way I am with my dad. I mean, those are specifics that they did not know. But I did a solo show, and they were aware, some of them, that aren't, you know, fans of the truth, of this truth coming out, I should say. You know, they were kind of on my back 6 years ago when I did the solo show, with a lot of emails judging my character and, you know, accusing me of not having compassion and forgiveness. And it's the antithesis of the truth, because I could never have done that solo show if I didn't adore my father and have a deep desire to understand all of him. So I do not compartmentalize my father. That's true. But I don't compartmentalize my family either. And they have every right. And there are a few that feel strongly that this stuff should remain a secret, should remain private, should remain. And that's okay. But my dad lived a complicated life compartmentalizing himself. And that is not what legacy I'm going to live and leave, because I think that's what created the problems in our household to begin with. So that's why the book is as transparent as it is. And that's why I am speaking the way I am. And I love my family. I have no hard feelings. And even that statement, it's like, I know where some of them are. And they'll find the light when they're ready. And I love them and trust that hopefully the day will come where it will be easier to just go, hey, you know what? My dad was gay. What's the big deal? What is the big deal? Yeah, he cheated on my mother. Yeah, these priests are this. I think they are having a hard time consolidating. And this is completely my opinion. I would guess they're having trouble consolidating the Catholicism that they're deeply devoted to, because interestingly enough, the few that are having the hardest time, I would say, are the most faith-based in terms of their Catholic practice, which is kind of interesting to me.
So
it may be bumping up against their faith a little bit too, where they have to consolidate their faith, their father, the homosexuality, the drinking, and the public angle of what are the neighbors going to think.
Sure. I was going to ask you too, of the 13, do you know how many at least self-identify as Catholic?
And I know that. Oh, as Catholic. So yeah, I mean, most of my siblings, and many of the ones that support me, are very devoted to their faith. They just have sort of a more inclusive philosophy, if you will, a more liberal philosophy. Probably everyone. I mean, it doesn't mean that they're all going to Mass every Sunday. But I would say absolutely the majority of my family, are practicing Catholics.
If they entered a hospital and they had to check a box under religion, they would check Catholic.
Oh, yes, I think so. And I don't think there's anyone who, if they had to check a box, they certainly wouldn't check any other box.
Right.
But I would just say some would be practicing and more lined up with the doctrine, the strict doctrine, I call it.
Sure.
That's my mindset. The strict doctrine versus a more liberal church. I mean, that's the difference. And I think there is an interesting line of those that are very supportive of me just telling my story. You know, it's just the truth. You know, nobody's going to die. And, you know, if people are spending time gossiping, you know, they need another life. They need a bigger life, you know, not another life. They need a bigger life. And sure, that's their problem. But more people are supportive. And I think that this story is bigger than my family is the last thing I wanted to add.
If you could answer this in just a minute, because we are down to the wire. I'm curious, the two brothers who abused you, you said you've forgiven them. Was there a spoken reconciliation? Was there a come to Jesus meeting among the three of you?
So I have had conversations with them over the years. It happened a long time ago, where I confronted them in my 20s. I started to get angry. I started to face what had happened to me. I've done, you know, decades of therapy, decades of work on myself to heal. But absolutely, they've apologized. In fact, I invited them to come on, Meg and Kelly. I have invited them to lean into this with me to help other people. And not be ashamed about it. They neither have taken me up on that yet. But hey, if they do, I'll call you back, and we'll have about the three of us
absolutely
get on the call together. You know what I mean? Because I'm all for that. You know, but yes, they've apologized. They certainly have acknowledged the pain they caused me, and I actually spoke to them. Well, one of them recently, before the Meg and Kelly, and the other one was an email of requests. You know, do you want to lean into this with me? So.
Okay.
I'm not close to them. That's the truth. I'm not close to them. That feels still difficult, but I'm
sure,
certainly forgiving and available.
Understand. Tina, this has been just a wonderful conversation, both today and last week as well. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing. And I just want to thank you and your listeners, and hope they'll read it and find some light in it for them.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Tina Alexis Allen. The book is Hiding Out, a memoir of drugs, deception, and double lives. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.